Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor William Klein from the Peterson Institute for International Economics. We met at the American Economic Association's annual meetings in New Orleans in January 2008, where Bill had just been speaking at a round table on the economics of global warming, a topic on which he first published a book in the early 1990s.
It was 1992, but you're right, and as we were talking about it, I realized that since that time, the world has warmed by 0.3 degrees Celsius, so it's warming even as we speak, and it has been a long time. I think the whole issue has come front and center again for a number of reasons. In the United States in particular, I think Katrina, in where we are right here in New Orleans, the hurricane, I think really captured people's attention in terms of a demonstration of the kind of stakes that are involved. I kind of think it could happen with unarrested global warming. I think Al Gore's film, Inconvenient Truth, also sensitized a lot of people. And of course, now we're coming into period of renegotiating Kyoto, coming into a period of change of administration in the United States, and of course, the Bush administration has been very much opposed to taking measures beyond small investments, in some sense, in technical change. So it's very much front and center again. And of course, I think the Stern Review that Sir Nicholas Stern prepared for the UK Treasury did a tremendous positive service to shift the state of debate, to place the burden of proof more on those economists who have been saying that it's uneconomic to do anything about global warming.
What do the economists bring to the analysis and understanding of climate change and the policies that we need to do to tackle it?
Well, in principle, the economists can say something about the efficient way to go about addressing the problem. They can try to quantify what kind of abatement programs make sense. I think, importantly, an issue is whether they serve as, in some sense, an obstacle to taking action by, in some cases, coming up with analyses that say, well, the damages are not particularly large. The cost would be large to cut back the use of carbon, so we shouldn't do very much. I think increasingly that sort of wing of the economic analysis has been called into question by greater emphasis on the uncertainties and the possibility of really large damages that are in sort of a thin tail of probability. I mean, the estimates of how much warming could occur were traditionally something like, you know, 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius for a doubling of carbon dioxide. The distribution of that has increasingly been toward pushed out toward the upper end in terms of the tail of the probability distribution. With that comes greater risks. I mean, the most staggering thing I've seen in the last year is work by geologists on the Permian-Triassic mass extinction events 250 million years ago, in which 90% of all species on land and in the oceans died off. Well, it just happens at that time there was a 6 degrees Celsius global warming, and without necessarily having the causation as a smoking gun, it gives one pause. And if you're talking about probabilities of massive damage, even if they're low probabilities, it pushes you toward taking action.
Now, your own most recent work, you've been looking at the impact of climate change on developing countries. Can you tell me a little bit more about that work?
Yes, what I did in this new book that came out from the Peterson Institute and the Center for Global Development is to take detailed climate model projections by the 2080s and connect them with models of agricultural impact of two types. One is a sort of the crop models that have inputs and outputs, and the other is so-called Ricardian models that relate the climate impact to agriculture by inferring its impact, looking at land prices in response to different climatological locations. And when I did that, basically what I found, I was quite, you know, concerned that the recent trend in the literature somehow seemed to leave the impression that, you know, some global warming might actually be beneficial for world agriculture. Well, as I estimated it, if you get out to the something like 3 degrees global warming and 5 degrees land-based warming, because the oceans warm much less than the land, that we are facing business as usual by the 2080s, the effects are negative globally. And if you depends on whether you have a lot of so-called carbon fertilization from a more rich carbon-rich atmosphere, but you could have something like a 5 to 15% global loss, even without taking account of greater incidence of severe weather, droughts in particular, or higher insect pests. Number one. Number two, the distribution of this would be very unfavorable for the developing countries, and it's strictly a consequence of the fact that they are located toward the equator. And the damages are greater toward the equator because that's where the temperatures are already closer to the limits of tolerance. One exception is China. China and the United States both have sort of a plus or minus outcome depending on how much you attribute to carbon fertilization. And both of them are centered at 38 degrees north. Well, India has centered at 22 degrees north. And closer to the equator, it has very severe damages, 30 to 40%. And even in India, or sorry, even in China and the United States, the southern halves of the country get damaged. So in sum, what this study attempts to do is to quantify these losses, and the big message to me is that the developing countries should make sure that this doesn't happen. And if they're going to do that, they're going to have to sort of get on board in international participation at limiting emissions, because their emissions are growing rapidly. China's already passed the European Union. It could pass the United States fairly soon in its emissions. And somehow, they have to be part of the solution to this, because they're the ones who have the most to suffer.
So is the key here really this agreement, this post-Kyoto agreement that we started on the road to in Bali, and I think we're aiming to get to by the end of next year? Is there some international agreement the absolute key to the tackling the problem?
Yes, an international agreement is the key. This is a classic problem of collective action to deal with externality. And it's particularly serious because if any single country, especially a small country, cuts back its carbon use, it makes a tiny impact for a small country on the global carbon concentration, and yet it has to pay the full cost of its cutbacks. So it needs the other countries to make commensurate reductions. I think the big challenge in this next phase is going to be how do you get the developing countries and the industrial countries to sign on to meaningful commitments to limit emissions, to limit the growth of emissions, and exactly how that's going to happen, especially what kinds of transfer payments, what kinds of commitments to transfer technology for developing countries will be required, is very much an unknown. But I think that there's a tremendous opportunity now because the U.S., of course, has been a key obstacle by not participating in Kyoto. It is now, I think, on the verge of changing toward participation. We've already had Australia completely turn around and decided to join Kyoto. So I think there are unique opportunities within the next year or two to make something really happen.
And what kind of technological changes do you think we might be looking at to deal with the problem? And what about what kind of economic mechanisms are going to encourage the development of those technologies?
Well, the main thing you need from the economic standpoint is a global price that incorporates the diseconomy or the negative externality that carbon emissions produce. Now, whether that should be, I mean, the European Union's trading price at the moment is 20 euros per ton of carbon dioxide, which is about $100 per ton of carbon. That if that were sort of made global, that would provide a fairly strong incentive for countries to shift toward non-carbon energy. It would provide an incentive, if reliable going forward, for inventors to devote time and resources to coming up with new technology. Now, what technologies do you need? I think that we have a lot of technologies already. France has demonstrated it can do a lot with nuclear power. Ethanol, although it's been getting a bad name because of the price of corn shooting up in the United States, But ethanol, the way the Brazilians do it, based on sugarcane, is actually quite effective in reducing carbon emissions. I think that a lot of energy is now being developed in solar and wind. There's a lot of talk about carbon sequestration in underground reservoirs and in a mechanism which I think would eventually make it possible to use the coal. That's perhaps the biggest uncertainty, because that could be an enormous opportunity, because coal is extremely abundant, and if we can use the coal without its contaminating, that would be very valuable. But there are concerns about, you know, just how safe is it, how feasible is it to develop this technology. So those are some of the things that are being considered.
Final question. Overall, are you optimistic or pessimistic about humanity's ability to tackle this problem effectively?
I guess I tend to be fairly optimistic. I think it's been a remarkable achievement on the scientific side for scientists around the world to come together on this and to continue pushing on it and probing on it. I think there are signs that the public is moving ahead. I mean, this is the United States. Several states are well ahead of the U.S. government. You know, the states are now going to sue the Environmental Protection Agency because it won't let them put you know, carbon emissions limits on automobiles. I think there is a momentum now which makes me considerably more optimistic than one could have been even 2 years ago.
Bill Klein, many thanks.
Thank you.